About 30 seconds. Okay,
you're listening to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Your escape to reality.
Today is Sunday, September something, I think it's 6th, and, thank you. And this is your host, Stephen Novella.
I'm sorry, I didn't even want to
join me, as always, are Rebecca Watson, Jay Novella,
hey guys,
and Evan Bernstein.
Hello.
Can we help you?
You gotta love Dragon Con.
It's Adam Savage.
The Q&A at the end of the show.
Is there security here? Can I get an alien over here and help me out?
And apparently, Bob Novella.
Hey, Bob.
Ahoy, you dumb, fucking bill drop.
Bob always wants to say that.
I thought we were above gimmicks.
Rebecca, this isn't a gimmick. He's always wearing that.
Well, welcome you, Dragon Con.
Touch me.
Bob's in his undead pirate costume for the listeners who are not here.
It works really well as a podcast.
Oh, yeah. So, gotta love Dragon Con. First, I want to say thank you to Derek and Swoopy for getting skepticism at science and podcasting into a huge convention like this. So, thank you, Derek. This is only our second year, but already, yeah, we love coming here. I mean, how often do you get to have your picture taken with Alex from A Clockwork Orange? It's a bitty well, little brother.
I'm hiding under the table. No, not in a sexy way.
Apparently, Malcolm McDowell's done some other role, minor roles, but we know what he was. Although Jay keeps calling him Roddy McDowell.
Yeah, Jay comes running over to me, and he's like, Rebecca, we met Roddy McDowell. I'm like, holy crap! What did he look
just
like?
Shut up. Put a hot mic here.
Oh, there's Derek. Thank you, Derek. And it's also great because we get to meet a lot of our skeptical friends from around the world that we only have a virtual relationship with and we don't get to see in person very often. We just met, for the first time, Dr. Rachel Dunlop from Australia, just this week. And, of course, many old friends now. Now, you're probably wondering what this picture's doing up there. We definitely notice, however, that the skeptics are not in costume. And it's starting to feel a little... Most of the skeptics are not... Actually, I hate to say this, but Jay, the four guys here, we had a plan to come up with a lame costume for Dragon Con. We were going to all grow goatees and come as our mirror.
Have a little stick on.
But we failed. We couldn't grow a decent goatee.
George Rob just grew one overnight.
It was pathetic. So anyway, here we see the lovely Cheryl Loxton, who was exploring steampunk as a possible skeptical costume. I think she pulls it off very, very well. But we had to replicate this experiment. So
you're really making that work.
So you can see Rebecca looking on adoringly from the side of the picture.
That's not adoringly, Steve. Because I was talking to her right then. You know what she was saying?
Dude, don't hush my mellow.
Don't take my catchphrase. Sure. That's mine.
That's yours.
Well, technically, I don't march mine.
This picture is George with his incredibly large, invisible girlfriend.
I love taking pictures of George Pratt because he's always the sharpest dressed guy in the room.
Yeah.
Which I suspect that's why he likes hanging out with skeptics. we lower the bar a little bit more. Here we see that Jay finally perfected that shrink ray he was working on.
That was one hell of a night, guys.
Though he insists that not everything shrunk equally. Wait for it. Last night, you know, at 12 o'clock, everyone's partying. Like, hey, we got to prep the show for tomorrow. We actually have a show to put on tomorrow. And this was, you know, Rebecca's response.
Yes, I am.
All right. So, we have a few news items we're going to cover, and then we're going to leave a lot of the show for the live questions. That's always our favorite part. We were looking through, we had a working dinner yesterday, looking through some news items, and Rebecca came across this item.
I did. I get a Google alert on the most ridiculous things, and one of them is UFOs, and the internet went crazy yesterday because Google mysteriously put up a UFO logo, and nobody could explain why, and for some reason, like, you know, normal people would be like, oh, okay, there's a UFO on Google. That's great. Not normal people flood the internet with comments like the one you see on the screen there, which I'll read in the style in which it is written. Actually, the logo appeared due to the fact that a video was released showing UFO activity in Moscow yesterday on September 4th. Look it up. And, you know, we got a chuckle out of this because, you know, it's, what is the caps lock and crazy people? Why?
Well, Rebecca, people use caps lock so much now, like, we need something past that, so I was thinking, we need super caps lock. We need to be able to make it twice as big and it actually has to make noise.
Right.
Or it needs to be blinking.
For when throwing caps lock isn't crazy enough for you. The best theory, though, for it, I saw was that yesterday in Exeter, New Hampshire, was a UFO festival. So maybe that's why. Maybe it's because of Dragon Con. Paris, honestly. The internet cares.
All right.
You're on money. So.
Is it the chocolate money?
No.
No, it's not. Don't eat it.
Don't cut my boot.
Bob will be a character for the rest of the show.
No, I'm showing you my hands. I didn't get anywhere near your booty. All
right. Now, we're looking at a picture here of the Mongolian death worm. You have to say it like that, otherwise it doesn't mean the same thing.
He's using super cast lock.
It's true. And this is clearly out of a D&D book.
Clearly. Right. The only thing more fierce than this is the Alaskan bullworm, which all you parents out there might get that reference. Otherwise, no.
No.
Not so much.
No one.
So the one, I thought I had heard of everything.
Take that one out of the act.
But even Joe Nickel, a famous cryptozoologist and skeptic, hadn't heard of the Mongolian death worm.
I heard of the Mongolian death worm. I love the Mongolian death worm.
You thought it was a dance, though.
It's part of my D-boy style.
That mouth clearly does D10 damage.
D10?
Don't work for that. We keep going.
I've been practicing my whole life for that.
I love the Mongolian death worm because, you know, take a creature that is not at all frightening. It's a worm. It's a worm.
It's
like the thing from Tremors. No. Tremors? Is that the one with Kevin Bacon?
Yeah. So, to make it scary, they say, okay, but it spits acid and farts lightning.
It's got big, nasty teeth.
Why are we talking about
this? We're talking about some guy called Richard Fry. Freeman, which I thought was the guy from Half-Life, right? So he thinks he found it, right? So he went, launched a mission into the Gobi Desert and said, we're going to find the Mongolian death worm, or the thing that sounds like that. And he now got his press releases out saying, after his expedition, he doesn't have the actual worm, right? But he says, the worm certainly exists. When we talked to people during our trip in Mongolia, they were all quite certain about that. They didn't believe it could spit electricity, but they did believe it was venomous.
Not idiots.
They're very afraid of it. A whole family packed up their tent hut and moved when they heard of sightings of the worm. So we launched a scientific expedition into Mongolia and came back with anecdotes. That's research money well spent.
Rebecca, could you please read the first two sentences with cap locks?
The worm certainly exists when we talk to people that are doing well. Billy, they're all quite certain of that. Okay, would you please read that with super caps
lock? I'll do that in my hotel room today, okay?
Since we're on cryptozoology, do you guys know what this is?
Right.
And when these things mature, they turn into aliens, of course. This fell into the hands, conveniently enough, of a taxidermist in Texas, who's going to preserve it for posterity. Now, these kind of weird creatures get found, dead animals that look weird, get found all the time. And rather than saying, oh, look at that weird dead animal that's hardly decomposed, now we've got an internet news cycle, it's got to be something supernatural, right? So if it's dogish, it's the La Chupacabra, right? That's what it is. Although...
He's clearly off his meds for the show, guys.
If you're going to say Chupacabra,
You're right.
But I think it's probably... here's the guy, Jerry Ayer, and he says, I don't want to be known as the Chupacabra quack, he said by telephone. People say there's a mythical beast and that I have one. I'll call it Chupacabra because people love it, but I don't know what it is. Jerry Ayer, Chupacabra. But, has anyone ever seen a coyote? They're kind of weird-looking dogs.
Yeah.
So half the time, these dog-like corpses that get found, they're just coyotes. Or they're coyotes that have mated with a domestic dog and produced something even weirder than just a coyote. But, they're funny-looking. They're not quite canines. They're funny-looking to us. So, anyway, it's easy. Especially if their fur is falling off and they're emaciated because they're... Either they starve to death or something.
Or mange.
Or they're mange, right. They look bizarre. Right.
See,
you're
inside that coin.
They're
not
going
to
be
like, look bizarre.
Bob takes off one of his pirate gloves. Bob, take the mask off.
You really need that hand.
What do you want me to feel naked?
You do not want to see my hair. The other side of that coin, though, is not only the animal bizarre, but the process of the coin itself is also kind of bizarre.
So, does Dr. Jones got the cane now? Really?
And you're talking about the good time view of the cane.
It's very easy to talk. And scientists leave putrescine and cadaveries.
Putrescine and cadaveries.
Put your lovely glove on and dance, monkey, dance.
Because it's my dad.
That's strange and sexy. Did I say that?
Okay.
We actually have a serious news item to talk about today. I highly recommend you take the mask off for this one.
No, I'm going to sneak out.
Then eat the microphone. You got to hear you.
How long have you thought about magnetic monopoles as a part of sales?
Once or twice.
Well, this story went... Can you hear me?
Yes.
My good friend Jack mentioned the title of this yesterday at dinner, and I had two reactions. First was, no way... The next one was, holy crap. Because I mean, I've heard about magnetic monopoles for years, so we've never discovered them. Kind of bizarre things that have been predicted by theory going back to 1931, the fall of Iraq. Basically, it's a naked magnetic pole, like just a magnetic north or south. If you take a hard magnet or a horseshoe magnet and break it too, you don't get north here or south here. You get north and south here and north and south here. So there's like a real theoretical reason why you couldn't have a bare magnetic pole. And it looks like a new scientist started to figure the name of that new species. I couldn't do that. New Zealand is really good.
Oh, the German?
Yeah,
when you do it.
Helmholtz Zentrum Berlin for material and what energy?
What energy?
And we have permission by Germans to do this.
We're serious.
Entire country.
Well, the idea is that they got this crystal, right? And very bizarre crystal, when you chill it near absolute zero, the geometry is incredibly bizarre. It's actually kind of like ice. You've got imagine a three-sided pyramid at the vertices you have in the atoms. And when you chill it really, really close to absolute zero, the atoms, which are really kind of like water magnets, they line up in a certain way. And in some instances, this creates a magnetic monopole in the middle of the pyramid. You can imagine four-sided pyramid in the middle and the bottom, you have this magnetic monopole, whether it's south or north, appears. And they didn't see this directly because the charges are so tiny, but using neutron scattering, they determined, and they firmly believe that these are real magnetic monopoles that could have some interesting applications of science. And I just found it very interesting. It's something I didn't think we would ever see. So we got it. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, I was definitely, when I heard this, my first reaction was, no way, magnetic monopole, I mean, come on.
That's something that you couldn't use your scientific and you would have me on that.
That was my second one, I was like, wow, scientific, the cycle were just right, I know I would have gotten Bob on that one. Because, this is like almost a mythic thing that, we've been saying for decades, oh, there's no magnetic monopoles, no one's ever seen one, they've been looking for them, maybe they exist, but, maybe they don't. So this is, if this pans out, as always, we have to say, this is one, one lab did this. If this is replicable and this is true, this is huge. Now suddenly there's magnetic monopoles. Like, through my whole life up to this point, there haven't been magnetic monopoles. I think, Rebecca, you were just talking at the last panel, somebody asked, how often do you get surprised and change your mind because of new evidence? Well, how about today? This is huge.
Well, yesterday.
But does it start out as a regular magnet?
Yeah, absolutely. They start out with magnetism and then they contrive a way to create a magnetic monopole. But Bob and I are talking, is it really a monopole or is the other pole just sort of diffused in the crystal somehow? I don't know.
It's always possible because they detected it in an indirect method, but these scientists, though, it's not just one institute and one study. This is an international team of scientists around the world, and it's actually a couple of studies. They also created these monopoles as a diffuse sort of gas. So these guys are extremely confident that they really have this, and we will see if it really pans out, but they're pretty confident about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is not called fusion, right? But this is still big. This is big enough that until it gets replicated, we're not going to be rewriting the textbooks, right? I mean, I think we need a little bit more. This has to be vetted a little bit more. But still, this is the first time anyone's made a plausible claim of having a magnetic monopole. So very cool.
I was excited because I thought it was magnetic monopoly.
The airplane? Maybe like the games like when you're traveling so that they don't move around the pieces.
Actually, when Jack announced it at dinner, I said, magnetic monopoles? I would have loved to have contributed something to that discussion, but I can't focus on anything while the same. That's all. Can't get your gun out. I have my hand of awesome.
So we love doing live questions and answers at our live events because we don't get to do this when we're recording the show from our living rooms, right? So that we're now up to the Q&A part of the show. Does somebody have a Derek? Somebody have a microphone?
Yeah, we're good.
Our good friend Joe Anderson with the microphone. I'll take the opportunity to thank Joe, who's actually been our chauffeur for the weekend. He's been driving us back and forth to our crappy hotel that we got stuck in.
You got stuck in. I'm here.
Thanks, Joe.
Have a hot tub.
We're gonna get better. We're gonna get better.
Just keep up.
You wouldn't believe the ridicule in your driver's.
Wow.
Are you named for the Submariner?
Yes.
Hi, my name's Joel. First of all, I want to thank you for all of the work that you're doing, that your colleagues are doing. In a time when something like the birther movement can actually gain legs, when parents can choose not to inoculate their children, the genuine heartbeat tells them not to, I really do wonder sometimes if our society is collapsing under the weight of its own laziness and ignorance. But what you guys do really gives me hope, and you are making a difference, so thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's not an easy job either.
But you're getting dried out.
My question is, how is Randy doing?
Randy is surprisingly spunky. The guy is really unstoppable. So, and I'm actually not sure what he's chosen to make public and not, so I'm not going to go into any details, but I have spoken to him recently, and the guy is just unstoppable.
Yeah, he was at TAM, and this happens every year, actually, at TAM. Everybody tells him, you know, you should really rest. And he's like, oh, okay, I will. And then you turn around, and then you look around, and he's, like, on stage, like, doing tricks and shaking hands. It's like, no, go nap. You're 82, 81 now? He's incredible.
Yeah. Good. All right, thanks. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks.
Awesome. Hey, Franco, it's nice to see you guys in person finally. I know a lot of you, or I guess most or all of you, have done work with science advocacy or skeptical organizations. In your experience, would advertising and marketing be a good skill set to bring into those sorts of movements?
Yes.
Absolutely. That's, for whatever reason, that seems to be the one skill set that we are most lacking in skeptical groups and communities. We suck at marketing. And the other side is fabulous at it, and they're well funded to do it. And I don't know if it's, I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's that the, it just doesn't fit well with the science thing. You know, we're sort of dedicated to truth, and we always joke about the fact that, you know, you talk to a scientist about any claim, and there's so many, you know, caveats, and but we have, you know, it gets deeper and deeper, and they're so cautious about the way they state the evidence, and that's just the way we think about things. If you're freed from that, if you're freed from having to actually care about scientific accuracy, then you can.
Is that your cell phone?
I don't know. Then we can, you're free to frame your message optimally for marketing, right? So being unhinged from the truth is a huge marketing advantage, right? And we don't have that advantage. But it's also that there's not a lot of people that, we get a lot of people who offer their talent and energy to the skeptical movement, and we love it. We have artists and musicians and web programmers and lots of people, and it's great, and it's making the movement so much more vibrant. But we still need people who have marketing savvy.
You know, I majored in advertising, right?
Yeah.
No, go on.
I understand. But just say, really, we
I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's right. Just stop me here. But who can, you know, really do for us what has been done for us in other realms?
All right, so to sum up,
yeah.
Do you have marketing skills? When you get them, call us.
We're catching up. You know, it's not all that hopeless, because I know a number of people who are marketing folks who are contributing, me, for one, and also my friend and fellow skeptic, Tracy King, in London. She owns her own marketing company, and she uses it to work for clients like Richard Wiseman, who does a fantastic job of branding himself, of putting himself out there, getting on YouTube, beautiful websites and things like that. So we're, you know, things are going right in many areas in terms of marketing. And on the topic of marketing, you know, it's often, I always used to get teased for going to school for marketing and communication. It's kind of a BS. Well, I did get a BS.
yeah, we know.
And, however, it's important for people, everyone, to understand what goes into marketing and what goes into advertising and how things are being sold to you. Everyone should get like a basic marketing textbook and read it, because it's really important. It's a wonderful thing to be skeptical about, and especially if you have children, one of the best ways to get them thinking skeptically is watch TV with them and say, now, do you really think that toy does that? Just get them thinking about the messages that are being thrown in their direction. I think it's a... Okay, I'll stop.
I'd say overall in the skeptical universe, like, things have changed tremendously in the past 10 years, like especially since podcasting and Web 2.0, everything has evolved so much. And I think the reason why we're all here is actually because of podcasting. I was just talking with Derek last night about this. But what we're waiting for is somebody in skepticism to penetrate to the next level. I'm not reaching for the Oprah level, but even, you know, getting our skeptical heroes to get on TV shows, to get much more publicity, to get the books being bought, to get, you know, more people involved, more money coming in, and, you know, get that snowball happening. But right now, we're still under the radar.
Hi, there's someone handing out Z-Guys flyers every night. I want to know, is it rational to beat the tar out of him? Because I saw his flyers twice, and he said something to me, I would have beat him up. I live only 20 miles away from Ground Zero and have to deal with this garbage a lot more than I'd like to.
We don't encourage violence.
No violence.
especially because it won't actually help. Although, you know, we do all love seeing Bart Sobral get punched in the kisser. But we actually had, I was just on a panel with TV's Adam Savage, and we had someone ask a question that was about, you know, the new study that came out that was about the something thermite being found at Ground Zero. It's like, this stuff just does not die. And the thing is, I haven't seen this new study, so maybe, okay. But there's no new evidence. You know, we go over it again and again and again, and this stuff will persist. I'm hoping it's died down now to the point where most people don't really buy into any of it, and that stuff's been so thoroughly debunked that I think the average person on the street knows that we know what happened.
I don't know what the recent stats are. I mean, it was up to like 30% of people were thinking that there was something
The problem with that, I think, is a lot of surveys say you think that the Bush administration had something to do with it. Jackasses, you know. So people will say, you know. So I think that it skews a bit. I don't think their numbers are very good at all.
Yeah, that's probably true. But I think the subtext to that question was, yes, there's a great deal of frustration at hearing BS over and over again that's been debunked thoroughly. But if you're going to be in the skepticism game, you absolutely just have to deal with that. You know, you just have to tell yourself, calm down, take it easy. Perry used to say, take it easy. That's going to Perry's favorite term. And just, you know, just calmly go over it yet again. You just have to be up for that. Otherwise, walk away. Because if you're going to get frustrated to violence every time he says something stupid to you, you can't be a skeptical activist, because that's going to happen every day.
I guess my question is maybe along the same lines, and that is, how do you parse out some of those things and along an ethical line? Because I work with the severely and chronically mentally ill, so I do work with people who genuinely believe things that are false, fixed, untrue, and genuinely hilarious. And
you have an example?
You know, I've had to run into another room so I can. So how do you parse that out so you could separate, you know, that crowd from, say, the, you know, the town hall meeting crowd?
It's not easy. I mean, and we've talked about this before, and I think the fact that I have neurological training I bring to bear a lot, because if I see that somebody has a lot of features, I think they're over that fuzzy line where I would say, all right, this is really a manifestation of mental illness, then I try very hard not to deal with it at all. But if it's a claim that's out there in the public domain that's being presented on television and, you know, on the internet and in movies, then we need to deal with the subject matter. So one way to deal with it is to separate the questions from the person, right? I don't want to deal with this person's psychosis, but let's just deal with the factual claims of did the towers collapse under their weight or was there thermite there? We can deal with those. So that's one way. And the other one is just to ignore, like, you know, now the iconic crazy guy that we will not bother to deconstruct his claims, right, is the time cube guy, right? You know, I think we're dealing there with somebody who clearly is across that fuzzy border into you know, a thought disorder. It's not worth deconstructing his claims, and we haven't, and we won't. That's separate the claims from the person and try to just stay away from the anonymous cranks that are really just serving nothing but their own thought disorder.
Hi, I'm Josh from Atlanta, and my question is for Bob, and you're all welcome to answer if you wish. In the near future, researchers will perfect self-replicating nanomachines. Would you be willing to volunteer to be the first person in a trial? The nanites can do whatever you want. They can repair your heart or give you telescope eyes or increase your decomposition.
Yeah. We talked a lot about this weekend, actually.
I will definitely not be a guinea pig. I will not be the first person on that line, but I will be the 100th and the 1,000th, definitely. But I don't agree with your premise, because the research has kind of abandoned the idea of self-replicating nanomachines, because obviously that's a pretty nasty scenario with great glue and all that. Now they're kind of going towards the idea of nanofab factories, like a printer that will be able to take in the raw material and molecule by molecule or whatever, construct what we need to construct based on the software that we need to use to the system. So that's kind of where we're going with that. Because, yeah, the self-replicating, that's a pretty scary scenario. It'd be really, you could imagine what, you know, you program these things. And you can lose the biosphere, and then a few days later, the biosphere is gone. So yeah, it's pretty scary here, and you're kind of away, you know, not dealing with that, and you're not going that direction anymore.
Also, I'll just point out that you say the first person. First person would not be the first living thing to get any kind of treatment like that. So, just for ethical reasons, we'll kill a lot of animals first.
Why don't we just build an animal or a human without a brain with the nanomachines and then test on them?
Don't get me started.
Yeah. That was the point.
That was on my deathbed, though, and I would do experimental research on me if I had no other recourse. And yeah, I'd take a shot at something, you know, out there like that going down.
Hi guys, this comes back to a marketing question. Right now, I feel like the people in this room, you guys, we have a marketing problem because we call ourselves essentially negative words. Skeptically is a negative word. Whereas you look at Jenny McCarthy's song, she calls herself an autism actress. Even though she's spreading our lives, she has a really positive, upfront kind of age. And so now we have, atheists, for example, calling themselves brights. I think that's a really bad marketing decision. So what kind of face can we put out there that has new marketing names for the...
Oh boy, we tried.
Okay, we talked about this yesterday, actually. Someone and I talked about it. Anyway, someone said yesterday, you can't choose your nickname. Don't try, because then you're going to be that douchebag in college. You know? Don't do it.
Skippy, really?
Right. Bright is pretty much a total failure at this point, I think. It was roundly mocked. And skeptic is not a negative term. Some people do have that problem. You're never going to take a word and keep it 100% pure and good and nestle it and raise it into a brand. You just can't do it. Skeptic is actually a word that's in demand. The 9/11 truthers took it. The moon hoaxers took it. Because it gives them power. Skeptic is a powerful word. And what I always advocate doing is not to abandon the word, but to...
Rebrand it.
Yeah, to rebrand it, to help people understand this is a skeptic. I'm a skeptic. Everyone I work with knows oh, Rebecca goes to skeptical events. She's a skeptic. And they also know I'm a pretty cool person and not like a giant jerk, you know? So I think it's up to everyone who considers themselves a skeptic to wear it, you know, be proud about it, tell people you're a skeptic, and slowly but surely we'll build up a positive brand around the word.
Also, 10, 15 years ago, skeptic seemed really synonymous with the word cynic. They were two words that were interchangeable. Now it kind of seems that skeptic is kind of losing that association, that negative association with cynicism, and hopefully that trend will continue.
And there have also been some very bright people who have tried to, over the decades, come up with the term to replace skeptic. And nothing else sticks. Nothing else really fits what we are. I think, and I've always been an advocate for embracing it and making sure that we define what skeptic is and who it is, not let other people define who we are.
And of course, if you want, you can always go with critical thinking. You can go with, you know, rationalist,
science-based.
You know, there are a lot of synonyms. But yeah, I don't think we should ever shy away from using the word skeptic.
Yeah, I think he was talking more community-wide, not as an individual,
right,
though.
Yeah,
basically, bottom line, two choices. Fix the perception of the word skeptic or come up with a better term. No one's come up with a better term, so we are trying to fix the perception of the word skeptic. And we're getting some traction. It's helping. We're not there yet. And also, in sub-projects, you can branch out into other things. Like I have the science-based medicine website, trying to brand the science-based, you know, logo, which is sort of spreading out to other things. There's now a science-based pharmacology site and a science-based parenting site. Some guy here is running that. So we're experimenting with different things. These things tend to be organic and chaotic, and you can't really plan them from the top down because that, like the Brights thing, that tends to fail. So we're just going to keep doing what we're doing for now.
Hi guys.
Hey.
Thank you for all you do. I really appreciate it. My question basically has to deal with public broadcasting, PBS. I've noticed recently, just before I got cable, I watched a lot of PBS, and they always have to run these, things to make money. And they get a lot of very woo kind of people involved in that. I was wondering maybe if the skeptical movement could possibly approach PBS and start really pushing ourselves out on public broadcasting networks.
Well, you should know that when they do fund drives, it's usually the local station.
Right.
And PBS is an organization that provides content to these various local groups. So there's really no there's no way to control like what these local groups are doing. But I made a good run at the public radio thing, and it was very difficult for me to convince them that there's an audience for skeptical programming. And there's a lot of crossover between public radio and public television. That's why I'm kind of lumping the two. And obviously, most of my experience was with the radio side. But they need a certain... They're just like a commercial station in that they want to provide the content that they think that their audience is going to want. And we just need to convince them that there is an audience there. And so, for instance, when I finally did my pilot show, Curiosity Aroused, it was tremendously received. And it actually did quite a bit better than, there were two other guys that did pilots at the same time. And Curiosity Aroused was picked up nationwide in, I think, maybe like 14 different major markets. And the others got like maybe two. And, the station owners were actually flooded with letters that they forwarded to me. I mean, it was a really wonderful response. But then what happens is that the individual stations don't have the money to produce the show. So they went back to the company that produced this one, PRX, and said, we want more. And PRX said, well, talk to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They're the guys who fund everything. Corporation for Public Broadcasting said, no, we don't think there's really going to be a market for that. So it's a problem of, it's mostly, to get funding, to just do a radio show, it takes, many tens of thousands of dollars. And you have to scrape and claw for every penny when it comes to the public channels. So
this kind of lends to what I was saying before about media penetration. Like, we just don't have the persona yet.
Yeah, although, you know, to mention, the Skeptic's Guide is played on several public radio stations around the country. It's usually the much smaller stations that happen to have a skeptic there who likes the show and needs to fill some airtime. And so we're played in, what would you say, like a dozen?
Something like that, yeah, five or six, I think. That I know of.
Something like that, but half.
Every now and then we get a request for another station that wants to broadcast the show, and I always tell them, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Imagine if we didn't have MythBusters and if we didn't have Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
We have shining stars out there, but for some reason, even though people love MythBusters, watch it, I can talk to anybody, non-skeptic, whatever. Most people that I talk to, they love the show. They still don't get that. That's science. That's critical thinking and skepticism. It just doesn't come through.
Oh, but one thing I do want to mention is that if you live in a large city or a city with a university, there's a very good chance that there's a radio station near you that plays, a lot of crazy alternative stuff, and they've got dead hours where they will put you on the radio, and all you need to do is contact them and say, I want to be on the radio, and
oftentimes, or you can ask them to run our show.
You might have to go through a quick course or something like that, but it's really remarkably easy to do, and you can actually get your own show, and you won't get paid for it, but you can be part of the the media that's putting out skeptical content. So well, I recommend anyone do it.
That's sort of the PBS model. If you can find funding or self-fund, then you can produce the content, and then you can try to get it picked up, by the affiliates. That's one of the things we're exploring with the Skeptologists, if you guys still remember that show. That's an attempt to try to get skeptics doing a show covering paranormal topics, but doing it from a scientific, skeptical point of view, but still telling a story, the kind of storytelling that can make it onto an actual mass market. One route to go is to find funding and then produce it and then just make it available to the PBS affiliates. So that's one way to get more science content on there. And it does get to the bigger problem of how do we make the scientific skepticism more sexy in a mass media sort of way, or at least convince the executives who seem to be stuck in some very narrow ways of thinking about things that it can be sexy. They still have some irrational thinking where, okay, but if every now and then you don't find that the paranormal thing's true, then that's not good storytelling. It's like, no, not really. We don't have to make up stuff in order for this to be good storytelling. Science is more interesting than the paranormal.
Yeah, but, MythBusters has proven that.
I know that, and it's wonderful that they have. Our episode that's airing this weekend is an interview with Adam Savage where we talk about that exact thing, about how do we capitalize on bullshit and MythBusters to spread more shows like that, and they have proven it. But how do we translate that into more? Adam says he's working on it. We're obviously other people working on it. We just have to keep plugging away and slowly chip away and break through. And you need to give us $10 million. I forgot to mention.
Are there any billionaires in the audience? Yeah. Fans? No.
Jennifer Murphy out there? No.
All right.
Hey,
really?
Hi. I want to thank you in particular. I love the whole podcast, but the science fiction part is my favorite. I have a son that's almost 14, and I'm sorry, he finds most of the podcast to be boring because he's a teenager.
So do I. It's okay.
If you love science fiction, it's something we kind of play along with you guys and listen, and then he loves Jay. He's Jay 20. I almost had him down here.
No, he thinks I'm stupid.
Stupid equals funny.
I almost had him down here. He was maybe one of his schools in person, but he decided to go see something else instead.
Almost is good enough for me.
But in that vein, I'm just curious, I know a couple of you are parents, what can we do to engage a younger crowd? I think a lot of us are sort of in a similar age range, and we have kids, mm-hmm. and particularly in the South, at least, they're bombarded with new and particularly sort of religious material all the time, and get invited to church, and just some ideas to sort of bring them into the fold, and skeptics in the pub is great fun, but we can't bring our minors to it, so how do we bring them in?
I'd like to go ahead, since he wanted almost.
Wait, can I just mention something real quick?
Yeah.
Skeptics are currently working on instituting more events for parents nationwide, and we're hoping to do things that are just like Skeptics in the Pub, but without the booze. So it could be, you know, like Skeptics in the Park, and things like that, like family days where you can bring all the kids out and have a good time. So.
I think all kids really like science. For some reason, and I've never met anyone that disagrees with that. There's something fascinating to them about it, because, you know, and whatever, we could talk about that for hours, reasoning why, but they do, and you can really hook them with that bug. And like doing what you're doing is a perfect example. You should do that. You should, you know, like Rebecca said, watch TV with them, talk to them. You know, buy things that are like buy them a telescope, and get involved yourself. I mean, you're going to learn too. You know, I mean, my brother Steve, like, became a birder by teaching his daughter about it, and now the two of them have this incredible hobby together, and like she rattles stuff, she actually can recognize the sounds of birds and identify them and everything. So we have a captive audience with children. It comes down to the parents teaching them, and that's where the best education can really come from. Those are the people that really should be teaching their kids science and skepticism and critical thinking. So you're doing it. Just do more.
Another thing is we're also trying to line up some interviews with producers of children's shows that are science-based to help, through our show, help spread the word. Kids who listen and so forth, so they can hear about these things.
You also get Sid the Science Kid on?
Yes, Sid the Science Kid is one of them. Yeah, it's a great show. Fish with Ruff Ruffman's another great show. If anyone's seen that, working on getting a hold of those folks so they can share their experiences and knowledge with us.
Yeah, I just also want to emphasize, you know, what I found to be most effective is just direct one-on-one attention to your kids. I mean, kids soak up adult attention. And you could parlay that into whatever you want. You know, recently, Evan and I took our younger daughters to the local museum. Yeah. It was a daddy-daughter day. We spent the whole day with them. But it was going through the Peabody Museum, you know, right near where we live. We, you know, we happen to have an awesome museum near us. But
why
was
not
there? You have some power thing.
Let's talk about Autumn, your daughter's detail.
Yes. No, this is Autumn, yeah, my younger daughter Autumn, who loves her Uncle Bob and loves the whole Halloween skeleton undead thing. So yeah.
Yeah, that's healthy. That's good.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. So Autumn and Rachel, we took a wonderful time because there were dinosaurs and even the minerals were interesting and the stuffed animal and everything, and you know, they have a certain amount of attention, and you know, that they could spend. And you know, Evan and I would throw in the science whenever we could, and make it engaging, play off of the displays. And, you know, ask them questions, try to make them figure things out. When they ask you a question, it's really good to reflect it right back at them. How could we know what color the dinosaur was, or whatever it is that they're asking, and just try to engage their critical thinking. And they soaked it up. So there's no substitute for time when it comes to kids.
Can I make it serious for one suggestion?
Yeah.
Can you invite other parents in your area to come out to the museum with you, and you take everybody's kids through and do that?
Yeah, that would be a good group event, absolutely.
Why don't listeners who are in Connecticut or the New England area write in, and we'll try to organize something.
Hey, you know, that like you were saying, the Skeptics in the Park type of thing, that actually is a fantastic idea.
Yeah, Boston Skeptics, actually, we did a trip to the Museum of Science, and a couple people brought their kids along, and we're going to do a lot more things like that. And in fact, I'm going to be traveling for the next few months, and so I'm not going to be able to host Skeptics in the Pub. And my friend Liz is a school teacher. She teaches preschoolers. And she's like, who's better to stand in front of a bunch of drunks? So she's going to take over for that. And she's got a lot of great ideas about running little mini skeptical camps and things like that, just like day-long things where parents can bring their kids out and they can learn, you know, critical thinking stuff while having fun with the parents. So, yeah, we're looking into a lot of things like that. Hi.
Can we call it Science Scouting?
Science Scouting? No. just kidding. Love it.
Hi, guys. My name is Josh. Love the show. I have two-part questions. One's really short. Can you please say hi to Richard Kleinschmidt? He's a friend of mine. He loves you guys. He can make it. But he's...
But yeah, can we say Kleinschmidt? And since we're saying hi to people, Rebecca, wasn't your mother's birthday yesterday or something?
Oh.
And happy birthday to Claudette, Bob's wife.
Oh.
And,
Happy birthday, Maddie.
Yes, happy birthday,
Maddie.
Just don't worry about it.
What kind of mystery is that?
Okay, part two.
I'm currently in grad school and they haven't kicked me out yet. I'm studying human primate evolution. And Richard's in the lab right down the hall from me. That's who you shouted at. So I get wrapped up in the creationism evolution thing a lot. And I was wondering if you had any opinions about why it seems to me, from my personal experience, that the majority of the semi-credentialed scientists on the other side
are engineers?
Are,
yes.
How did I know you were going to say that?
That has been made. I wrote an article about it. And you can actually find it on the NEST website. We have all of our old articles up there about engineers and the second law of thermodynamics. I don't know. I can only speculate. I have to always reinforce, this is not a knock against engineers or that type of science. I think, you know, that which, I think that
the company is mocked.
Right. So, there are different specialties within the field of science, and I find that there are cognitively, there, you know, if you sort of map out the different sciences, and there are some sciences that are farther away from other sciences, you know, than others, right? So there's like a sort of a clinical cognitive knowledge that people have that doesn't, you can't really be a good physician because you're a good astrophysicist, right? The thought processes are just too different, even though there's the underlying core logic is the same, you know, the scientific method is the same, but then there's just the skill sets with clinical stuff that doesn't apply to astrophysics and the other way around. And I think the historical sciences of evolution are pretty far away from the kind of skill sets that engineers develop, so they're just not prepared, I think, to deal with the kinds of claims that are being made in evolutionary biology. So, but those who are otherwise well-educated scientists and understand, you know, have learned about evolution, will do with, they're probably very bright and they learn with it. I think the problem is when engineers think that, and I've had engineers tell me this in many contexts, other types of scientists as well, it's not unique to engineers, but say, I'm an engineer, I know how the scientific process works. Well, you know how a subset of the scientific process works, and that subset does not apply very well to this separate subset of evolutionary biology, or sometimes it's been in the context of clinical decision-making. Clinical decision-making is totally alien to the kind of decision-making you make as an engineer. An engineer once said to me, well, you got to push a system till it breaks, then you know where its breaking point is. Yeah, we don't do that in medicine. That's
thank you.
We have 5 minutes to go, so we have to kind of close up.
One more question?
The alien has a question.
Yes, the alien.
Come up here, sir.
You don't fart lightning, do you?
Well, there's no way I can
correct
myself, even if I wanted to.
Oh, it's
out of sound. I'd like to know, what do you guys think of the connection between skepticism and being an atheist or an agnostic? Is it something that's totally separate?
It's rational thinking.
You have to be at least an agnostic and you're too skeptic or can you be religious?
Two words. Bill Maher. You can be one and not be the other.
There is no such thing as a true skeptic. Yeah. And the way I like to describe it is that, you know, there is the idea of there being a skeptic, it doesn't really exist. We talk about skepticism, it's a process that you use. And you can choose to apply that process to your entire life, to a little portion of your life. I try to hit the entire span, but not everybody does. And so, yeah, it's possible to be to consider yourself a skeptic, still be religious, and it's possible.
But most of us are either atheist or agnostic.
I think the only survey I'm aware of, which I think was published in the Skeptical Inquirer, is that 70% overlap. So that's the figure that I have in my head. I don't know how really good that data is.
You know, survey to survey.
Yeah, it makes sense. Take that with a grain of salt. And that kind of fits my rough, you know, sort of anecdotal experience. That, yeah, it's about a 70% overlap between science and skepticism and non-belief in terms of the religious views of our culture, because also you have to say, what religious views, right? We're probably all skeptics. As Randy says, what do you mean, Thor? Do I believe in Thor? No. I mean, most people here don't believe in Thor. But so there's a lot of overlap for obvious reasons. However, people are different, and you know, some people really love science and are really apathetic towards religion or hold odd religious views, and that's fine. Or other people really think that that religion is an evil scourge destroying our world, but maybe it's kind of soft in terms of their dedication to science. the overlap is not 100%, and that's okay. That's the other thing, is that's okay. I don't think that we should ever take the approach that we need to have a litmus test for what's a true skeptic or skepticism or what we, you know, how to go about doing things. We try to say it's all good, you know, as long as you want to learn and you want to investigate stuff and you care about, you know, rationality and truth. You know, this is the big tent skepticism is always the approach that we've up here taken. We have our certain things that we care about more. You know, we care about science. That's what we kind of focus on. But it's all good, and we try not to get, like, narrow or judgmental about how we're supposed to do this or how we should do this or what qualifies as a skeptic. I think that's any kind of an exclusivity kind of approach is not a good idea.
We have 1 minute left.
Okay, I just want to mention, like, not only, like, that's an awesome costume, and there are a couple of others. I just want to randomly call out you on the end. You're wearing my favorite t-shirt ever. I own that t-shirt. It's the Yeti corn saying I don't even exist, and it's hilarious.
Is Richard Saunders here?
We were at his podcast.
He's going to be
sleeping. He's going to be bummed.
All right, so. First person to raise their hand correctly with this.
Good job, sir.
Ready? Everyone ready? Who wears a large? The guy in the blue shirt.
Just throw it to
him. Now, come on up.
Well, the t-shirt.
Yeah. This is our new t-shirt. You can buy your own in the booth all the way in the back. We have 3 shirts there. We appreciate
your size.
So we have 3 We appreciate your donations.
Well, that was our live recording from DragonCon 2009, and now we're all back at home, back in front of our computers. So, what'd you guys think?
I miss DragonCon.
It was awesome. It was a lot of fun.
I want to be back there. Oh, shut up, Bob. You had so much fun.
I loved it.
It's off the hook.
What's not to love?
Hanging out with, like, I love all you guys, but I don't get a lot of time with Bob, and hanging out with Bob was so much fun.
Oh, yeah. I feel the same way.
In particular, going, like, I so wanted Howling Mad Murdoch's autograph from the A-Team.
You mean Barkley from Next Generation.
Exactly. Isn't Bob's like, Howling Mad Barkley. I'll go with you. Sure. I'm like, please, someone come with me. Bob's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Who the hell is that? And then we walk in there. He's like, who is it? I'm like, that guy over there. He's like, oh, my God. He's from my favorite Star Trek episode.
For the record, I knew who Dwight Schultz was. The cool thing was that, yeah, he's off the hook. I love him. But there's a lot of people there that are, I'm a big fan of, but just doing it with Rebecca is what made it so special, because I didn't talk to anybody else.
Bob, I've never had a chance to really connect with, you know, like, obviously we connect every week and I adore Bob, but
it was our special little moment.
It was, and it was really good.
It was fun.
I know, I enjoyed all of Dragon Con, though. That was amazing. I can't wait to do it again. Let's do it again.
I want to do it
hard. How about next year?
I want to do it hard next year, though. I mean, like, Thursday to Monday, not this Friday to Sunday crap.
That's what I did. And you guys need to stay longer.
Right, and we need to go in costume. Hello, all of us, not just the pirate skeleton.
Bob, you need all to help of us. Me with the costume.
I'll help everybody. We just got to brainstorm what would be good as a group.
We should do a group costume.
Well, we were trying to do, towards the end of Dragon Con, me and a few other people, like Cheryl Herbert, Daniel Loxton's wife, and Jay and whatnot, was come up with the skeptically themed costume.
Yeah.
Yeah, challenge.
Can I say, I adored Cheryl. I had never had a chance to hang out with her either. And she was awesome because she did exactly what I wanted to do, which is build an entire costume at Dragon Con. Like, she shows up one day and she looks totally normal, and then an hour later she's like, dudes, look what I got, goggles.
Steampunk.
And then and we're like, yeah, those are cool goggles. And she goes away, and a few hours later she's like, and a corset. And then she's got, like, the bustle and the skirt. She was just awesome.
Yeah, I got to hang out with her and Daniel. We walked around and we're doing the whole costume gawking thing, and we had a blast. Like, we were just like trying to get caffeinated and freaking out. There's so many awesome costumes there. I mean, you guys told me about this last year. I had no idea. It's a freak show.
Yeah, I wasn't there last year either. So I thought I was going to come and be like, I thought I would feel completely alone and freaked out by all of the nerds. But instead, it was like, oh, these are my people.
Well, because there's like two cons going on there. There's a skeptical conference, right? Skeptical science and podcasting tracks there. And that's a couple of hundred, 200-300 people that, you know, a lot of the people in the skeptical community, all of our friends that we don't get to see but once or twice a year, like Phil Plait and Richard Saunders or Brian Dunning, or we're all there trying to hang out with each other. And plus, a lot of our listeners are there, and just, you know, skeptics, new skeptics who didn't know we existed, you know, who meet us at the con. Mm-hmm. But it's embedded in Dragon Con. So you could take a break and walk around and walk past Darth Vader and
Sauron.
Lego Boba Fett.
Just unbelievable stuff.
But yeah, like, even the people who were just there for Dragon Con, who had never heard of skepticism at all, were so cool. And I think one of my personal favorite moments was I did a panel with Adam Savage, which was so much fun, and a woman got up to ask a question, and she directed it at me. Like, I'm at a panel with Phil Plait and Adam Savage and Scott Sigler and Melissa Kirchner, and she asked me a question, which is awesome enough, but then she asks about, like, pregnancy pseudoscience, and she says she's never heard of me or Skeptic, but she loves the whole idea of there being a skeptical movement.
Right.
And I love that. I love, like, reaching an audience that just didn't even see us coming, who still tolerate us and even maybe like us.
It's just the second year of the skeptical track at Dragon Con. It's definitely very successful. So, you know, we have to give kudos to Derek and Swoopy for basically bringing skepticism and podcasting to Dragon Con.
Well done.
Oh, yeah. They did a wonderful job. And they even managed to live stream a large chunk of the Skep track, and so people at home could tune in.
There's so much going on at this convention. I mean, I didn't know that there was a panel on cryonics, and a listener to the show contacted me on Facebook last week and just said, would you be interested in joining our panel? I was like, oh, my God, yeah, it'd be great. And I had a great time.
Yeah, there was actually too much to do. There was so much going on.
I was on a panel about the apocalypse that was on the apocalypse track.
God, awesome.
It was an entire track of apocalypse stuff. And if any of you guys running the track, like, I had a blast. I really enjoyed doing that panel. But if any of you are listening right now, you need to have the rest of these guys on. Like, Bob needs to come on and talk about zombies.
Yeah, you got to have us talking about the zombie apocalypse. I mean, come on.
I so wanted you guys on that panel with me, because that would have rolled. So maybe next year.
Yeah, the last year for that track will be 2012, though. So
right.
Enjoy it.
The last year for every track.
Good one, good one.
Well, we didn't do a science or fiction during the live show because we just had the hour. We wanted to leave a lot of it for Q&A. So we're going to do the usual wrap-up stuff now. We're going to do science or fiction. Who's that noisy? So here we go.
Let's do it.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Let's do it.
I'm so ready.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. Item number one. Programmers have demonstrated visual recognition software that is able to read captcha distorted text as well as humans. Item number two. A team at MIT has finally figured out the three-dimensional structure of cement. And item number three, engineers have developed the first functioning electrical circuit that runs entirely off the energy inside a tree. Evan, go first.
Yes.
Okay. So these programmers apparently have demonstrated visual recognition software
able to read CAPTCHA distorted text as well as humans. Yeah, I mean, that's entirely plausible. I'm surprised that CAPTCHA isn't already sort of this behind the times kind of security feature.
Real quick, CAPTCHA is when you go to a website and you see disoriented letters or skewed letters, and then you have to type them in, and the idea is that, you know, software would not be able to see that and interpret it as the letters. It's a very complicated thing. But
yeah, it's the thing that wasn't working on the SGU contact page for a long time.
Now, to see it as well as humans, though, that might be the catch there. So I'm going to come back to that one. The second one was the team at MIT that finally figured out the three-dimensional structure of cement. I think they figured out it was like a cube or a block, like a cinder block. So they finally figured that out. Good job, MIT. And then the last one, engineers developed the first functioning electrical circuit that runs entirely off the energy inside a tree. I think I'll need some explanation as to exactly how that works. I mean, I'm sure that's reality, but first functioning electrical circuit that runs entirely off the energy inside a tree. Well, I think that one's all right. So it's either CAPTCHA or the MIT team. And I'll say the CAPTCHA one is fiction, because they probably have the software that comes close to reading it as well as humans, but maybe not quite there yet, maybe 80% or 90% of what humans can do. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think it's the as well as humans that's throwing me as well, because I haven't read this study at all, but there are programs out there that, or at least people are working on things that can read text, written text, scan it, and translate it into words. But I don't think it's to the point yet where it's as good as a human eye. So I'm going to agree with my buddy Evan and say that that is fiction.
We are buddies, aren't we?
High five, Evan. High Woo-hoo! Five.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, save the high five for the end.
All right,
Jay.
Programmers have demonstrated visual recognition software that is able to read CAPTCHA distorted text as well as humans. That's really interesting. I mean, you know, the obvious joke, like Evan said, is, you know, I find it hard to read myself sometimes. I did think the first time I found out what CAPTCHA was, or I had used it, I remember thinking about it and wondering, you know, when are they going to be able to crack this one? So I don't think it's that far out there that they could come up with a software that could take that image and be able to analyze it. The second one, a team at MIT has finally figured out the three-dimensional structure of cement. I don't know. I mean, I am sick right now. I'm heavily medicated. I don't get this question or this statement.
Special pleading.
Steve, three-dimensional structure of cement?
Yeah.
There's got to be other people out there listening to this show that don't understand what that is.
Well, there are three dimensions.
Yeah, what do you mean? Like how cement, like, connects to itself, how it binds to itself, and how whatever kind of...
All right, you know how you wore special glasses when you saw up?
Yeah.
It's like that.
You mean like what makes cement stick to itself, what makes it harden, how, you know...
That's close enough.
Think that we would already know, since it's so unbelievably widely used and tested and everything, that wouldn't we know the chemical makeup of cement and then how that plays itself out? I don't know. I would think that we would have...
Maybe we did, but the team at MIT didn't, and they finally figured it out.
I would find it hard to believe that we didn't have a very strong idea about how cement works a long time ago. The third one, engineers have developed the first functioning electrical circuit that runs entirely off the energy inside a tree. Absolutely. I really could buy that. That makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say that number two is the MIT figuring out the three-dimensional structure of cement. That's the fake.
Okay, Bob?
I'm going to start with number two about cement. I'm going to disagree with you, Jay. It's a little bit of a surprise that we don't have it entirely figured out, but also on the other side of the coin, I'm not really surprised that there's some subtleties to cement that we haven't, apparently until now, truly figured out, that ultimate unit of cementness. So that one doesn't surprise me that bad. The electrical circuit running off the tree energy, yeah, that one sounds pretty plausible to me too. I remember reading about robots that were being developed that actually ran off of like food metabolism, trying to get energy like animals do, living things do. So then this one just seems a very similar idea to that. So I'm not too surprised about that one. The capture one, no way, kids. It's not happening yet. That is the one of the holy grails of visual recognition, is to have machines that can read capture as well as humans. I definitely would have heard about that. That would be big, big news if they were able to do that at this point. If they'll crack it, definitely at some point, but not quite yet. They have not figured that out yet. It'll happen, but that's definitely fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that engineers have developed the first functioning electrical circuit that runs entirely off the energy inside a tree, and that
one... We are
one
so on to you, Steve.
...is...
Science!
Science!
Yay, science! Yay, engineers.
Science!
So, yeah, you just plug this thing into a tree.
They put, cool. They our energy circuit, problems are solved.
You put one wire into the tree, the other wire into the dirt, and it generates a weak, you know, current.
It's called the ground.
That's the electricity of life, man.
Yeah, you're not going to get much off of this, very, very little. But this could have practical applications. Specifically, if you need to have, like, monitoring devices out in the woods, you could plug them into the tree. And, you know, if it doesn't require that much juice to keep going, it could be, you know, self-sustaining in that way. They say that it could generate a voltage of up to 200 millivolts. It's not very much.
No.
But take a whole bunch of trees, and if you could plug them all
gigahertz
together or something. And
right. So that one's true. We'll take them in reverse order. A team at MIT has finally figured out the three-dimensional structure of cement. Jay, you think this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one
science
is science. And this one is, hang on, whoa, is... science.
Oh, come on, man. Like, really? I'm like...
Really?
I'm so off on this game this year. It's ridiculous.
Oh, hugs, Jay. Hugs.
And actually... cement's been around for a couple thousand years, and we actually didn't really understand its three-dimensional structure. There were some theories. We thought that its structure was similar to a mineral called tobermite. Nope.
Toblerone.
Yeah.
That is the most delicious mineral.
Tobermerite. But what they figured out is that the way they describe the three-dimensional structures, if you imagine a plane composed of crystal triangles,
yeah,
but every now and then one of the triangles is flipped perpendicular, either up or down, and is embedded in the layer of triangles above or below it. So that's how you that's how it binds itself together, right? And they said that it's a hybrid between a crystalline structure and an amorphous structure. So it's partly like glass and partly like a crystal, and they figured out this way in which it embeds together. So they did not previously know that.
And I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, we've been surprised that we didn't know. It's been around for 2,000 years. But it's been a tough nut to crack in terms of figuring out exactly how the structure forms internally.
I mean, the Romans used concrete.
Yeah,
you know?
Parthenon. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm surprised to hear it, but it also just goes to show you, with all the science that we've done over the last 150 years, there's so much we still don't know, even about things that we're surrounded by.
Right. Well, here's one less thing we don't know anything about. All of this means that programmers have demonstrated visual recognition software that is able to read capture distorted text as well as humans is completely fiction.
Yeah.
Complete fiction?
It is complete fiction. In fact, scientists have recently done a study looking at the best capture visual recognition software and concluded that it is nowhere near human ability at this current time.
Wow. So my 80 to 90% accuracy is way off base.
Do you guys know what CAPTCHA stands for?
Yes.
Can't actually participate. No.
Well, I used to know. I mean,
it means completely automated public Turing tests to tell computers and humans apart.
That's right. That's correct. Yep.
Yeah.
How long did it take them to come up with
that? Awesome. That's cool.
That probably took a long time to come up with.
Right.
So, but my question to you is, Steve, then why has CAPTCHA slowly evolved over the past few years to be more complicated? Why wouldn't they just keep the original version of it?
What did the original look like?
Well, a lot easier to read.
Well, what they found is that even with the best programs, it does not tolerate deviations from a standard set of letters well at all. And that's, and it's interesting, you know, what the human brain does better than computers and what computers do better than the human brain is an interesting topic. This is one of those things. This certainly visual recognition in general is something that human brains do exceedingly well. But this in particular is something that human brain does well, matching patterns that are representative, you know, but not specific. You know what I mean? So how, like, that's how, there could be so many different fonts, right?
Right.
I mean, how is it that you can recognize a letter A in 1,000 different fonts? There's the A-ness about it that your brain gets, that it understands.
Pattern recognition, sort of.
Yeah, it's absolutely pattern recognition, exactly. But it's more than, it's an abstract form of pattern recognition that we're very good at, that computers are just, they're not functioning in that way.
I read about hackers that actually use people to do the captcha because we're so far away from actually automating that. They just have people do it. It's very slow, of course, but they need the people. But another aspect of that, though, is that I think it's a great way to, you know, perhaps like accelerate the evolution of computer pattern recognition, because you know these hackers are working on this hard.
Yeah.
Hard. Or whoever cracks that, I mean, if somehow a hacker can crack this before, say, MIT, boy, for a little while, they're going to have quite an edge.
But I wonder, Bob, is this a software problem? Is this the kind of thing that raw computing power is going to be able to overcome? Or is it that human brains are massively parallel and nothing short of that is going to be good at this kind of problem solving? You know?
Perhaps. I mean, what if, have they ever tried using a high-end supercomputer to do this? I don't think so, but I don't think it would, even a high, you know, or the highest, the fastest supercomputer could handle it.
Well, here's my prediction. I think that with current hardware designs, we'll be able to do this with a virtual model of the human brain, or at least that subset of it, like the visual cortex,
right,
which we're already working on. And we've already shown that virtual models of columns or parts of the human brain can actually function as software, right? It actually can do do the function that you're duplicating. I think that could be a pathway to solving CAPTCHA, making a virtual visual cortex, basically. All right. Well, we don't have that much time left, so let's do.
Let's get right to it. Here it is.
Months I've tried to keep this thing from happening, but I now see it's the will of sovereign being that this happened to us, that we lay down our lives in what's being done. The criminality of people, the cruelty of people. Who walked out of here today? Did you notice who walked out? Mostly white people.
And a lot of people guessed that correctly, that was in fact the Reverend Jim Jones.
Jimmy Jones!
The final recording of the most horrific, one of the most horrific recorded events in human history. I mean, if you go back and you listen to that entire 45-minute segment of, you know, his final babble as people are committing suicide in the background with children screaming.
It was more of a mass murder, actually.
As they're dying. Yeah, okay, mass murder. I agree with that. It was very hard to listen to and have to actually pull some sort of audio. But we need to be reminded that
what people are capable of.
Yeah. Yep. And what lack of critical thinking can do.
Yeah. Profound
to,
lack.
Large amounts of people. Yes.
I'm actually cool without the reminder.
You're good.
I don't really need the reminder.
All right, I promise I won't use that again.
I read it.
Ever.
I read it myself. Thank you.
No problem.
All right, what do you got for this week, guys?
I wrote on I have a little whiteboard here, a little dry erase board. Remember, humans are dicks.
who got that first, Evan?
Marty from the message boards. Congratulations, Marty. And a lot of other people picked up on it, too.
Yeah, we saw a lot of correct answers there.
However, there is this week's, which I'm going to play for you now, and we'll see who gets this one.
That sounds familiar.
All right, folks, so give it your best shot. Good luck.
All right, guys, so when this show goes up, we will be at the first NexusCon.
I can't wait, guys. I cannot wait. That's not the only cool event coming up. If you guys miss Dragon Con, like half the people at Dragon Con are going to be at Nexus. And then the following Tuesday, the 15th, mm-hmm. we're going to have a very special Boston Skeptics in the Pub with special guest, Australian scientist, blogger, and podcaster, Dr. Rachel Dunlop, a.k.a. Dr. Rachie. So I'm really looking forward to that. We're going to have so much fun. We always do.
We're going to go back to the live show just for the quote, and that will end out the show for this week.
I have a really awesome quote. This quote, obviously, as you can read it, but I'm going to say it. This guy walked by the table yesterday, looked at the skeptic sign and everything, and was, "Skeptics, they only believe in science." And pretty much, we all like were like, "Really?" All right, so this guy's name is Anonymous Dragon Con Loser. Thank all of you guys for coming. It's always awesome to be at these live events. Thank you so much.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.